Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 25th of February. Joining us in just one moment, Stephen Hess. This guy is so good and has such a breadth of political experience. When he was 25 years old, he was the number two speech writer for Dwight Eisenhower. How's that? And he's not 25 anymore, so he's looked at the transitions of presidents and he's written a wonderful book with suggestions of which president picture should be hung in the Oval Office. And I'm not sure whose picture is there right now, but he's big on George Washington. So he would recommend George Washington and then George Washington and then George Washington and then George Washington. Stephen Hess joining us, author of What Do We Do Now? A Workbook for the President-Elect. It's our winter membership drive. I'm here to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know that listener donations are the foundation of our budget. So we're asking for your gift, WPR.org or toll free at 888-202-2552. Joining me is Mike Crane, Acting Director, Chief Operating Officer for Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning to you, Mike.
Good morning. And our goal for this hour is to raise $2,500,
right,
helping us to pay for the Ideas Network and all of the things that you enjoy on Wisconsin Public Radio. And meeting that goal helps us to pay for the programs for the next few months. Make your pledge right now online at WPR.org or call toll-free 888-202-2552. Your contribution of $35, $60, $120, whatever works for you, any amount you choose. You can be a member for a buck if you'd like. Just get involved and get in touch at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We've been through such an exciting election and given you so many superb guests, and that continues after the election. Stephen Hess joining us. He has a breadth of experience with Democratic and Republican administrations. He's the author of What Do We Do Now? A Workbook for the President-Elect. We have marvelous guests on this show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for all the work that she does. Just yesterday, Elizabeth Alexander, who wrote the inaugural poem. George McGovern was with us last week. Bob Dole has been on this program. We have the opportunity to hear your opinions and comments, take your questions, and a lot of that is due to listener contributions.
So think about how much you enjoy the Kathleen Dunn program and how much it enriches your life. Then make a contribution to support it. You can do that very easily right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Support this intelligent source of news and information by donating at WPR.org. You can put your contribution to work instantaneously by making your pledge with your credit card. It takes just a moment of your time, and you'll be investing in a service that keeps you informed every single day. Your contribution in any amount provides essential support to Wisconsin Public Radio. I particularly would be delighted to have you pledge this hour. The quality of this guest cannot be surpassed. Stephen Hess, go to WPR.org right now or 888-202-2552.
You know, we try to be very timely when we're choosing topics and guests, and I think probably one of the most common comments we hear is how much people enjoy all things political. And just a regular feature of Kathleen's program, it's made possible because of people like you, because you want to hear in-depth discussions that go beyond the daily headlines. And it's very easy for you to pledge your support, maybe as a new member or as a renewing member, maybe make an additional gift. You can make your contribution at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
And for your pledge of $120 or more, which is about an average pledge, you'll receive our WPR member card. It's a card in your wallet that represents what you value, and the member card will help you save money and not spend it. And here is how.
It's very easy. You can get two-for-one deals.
Great.
Yeah, from participating restaurants, B&Bs, and cultural attractions. I remember using it recently and thinking, wow, I got to try out this new restaurant, and it was really good, and I saved a lot of money. And that's with a pledge of $120 or more. You'll receive the member card, and you can get that online at WPR.org when you click Donate Now, or call toll-free 888 888- 202-2552.
Or with your pledge of $35, you can get our WPR reusable shopping bag. I've been using these extensively, not this one, we just got it, but other ones I know you're concerned about. You know, you hate the plastic. Is it the plastic or is it the paper? And there are news reports that certain states may be charging now for plastic bags. Well, you don't have to worry about that. If you pledge $35 or more, you can get the WPR bag from the list of thank you gifts. It's a green bag, so is the concept. It'll keep paper and plastic out of the landfill. It's lightweight, and it folds up. It's kind of nifty. It folds up into a little tiny pouch that you can keep in your purse or coat pocket. So make your pledge to WPR now and enjoy this thank you gift. It is available only on the web at WPR.org.
So we're just getting started. Our goal is $2,500 for this hour, and we hope you'll really enjoy the conversation and that you'll take just a little bit of time to set aside 3 minutes to talk to someone, or maybe even go on the web and do it while you're listening. WPR.org is the web address. 888-202-2552 is the number to make your pledge. Help us to reach our $2,500 goal this hour.
Thanks so much, Mike, and get those calls rolling in. I know you're going to love the conversation. Stephen Hess is our guest, Senior Fellow Emeritus in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He joined Brookings in 1972. He is now also Distinguished Research Professor of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. He has advised on every transition since he was a young aide to President Dwight Eisenhower. He served on the staffs of Richard Nixon, Presidents Gerald Ford, and Jimmy Carter. He was a U.S. representative to the UN in 76, the UNESCO General Conference in 74. He has been Deputy Assistant to the President for Urban Affairs in 69 and has participated in many U.S. cultural missions around the world. His book is What Do We Do Now? A Workbook for the President-Elect. He, of course, watched the President last night during his non-State of the Union, State of the Union address to Congress, so he will comment on that as well as a number of different topics. Stephen Hess, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's a pleasure, Kathleen. I note one difference. Since you're in Pledge Week, here in Washington, we have two public radio stations, so I have to contribute to two. I have to contribute to WAMU and WETA. So folks out in your neck of the woods have it easier.
Yeah, they do.
And in fact, I don't know if you're giving as a gift. We just got the other day a digital radio.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, but great. I haven't set it up yet, so I don't know what it's all about. But I'll let you know. At any rate, we're great fans.
Good.
In fact, let me just say another plug. We are so great fans going back so many years that whenever we go abroad, we will write to the correspondent over there and see whether they'd like we could take them to dinner. So in that way, we
Stephen.
Became great friends with Sylvia Poggioli, of all people.
Oh, Stephen,
we've
what
had
a great story.
Good.
All right, Pledge.
Okay.
You know, with that, here's a number, 888-202-2552. We'll just have you pledge. Stephen, what a career you've had. I love the book. I just think it's so well done. And we think about the breadth of your experience. 25 years old, you're a speechwriter for Dwight Eisenhower?
Yeah, that was all an accident. Actually, I was a private in the Army. I had been drafted in the Army in 1956. I worked my way up to private first class by 1958 when I got out of the Army. In the meantime, my old professor at Johns Hopkins University, Malcolm Moose, had become the speechwriter to the president. So he was the one who invited me in. And so when my students now say, well, how do you get to be speechwriter at 25? I say, well, be awfully nice to your professor, you know. it was a marvelous experience. In part, it would always have been a marvelous experience, but particularly so because in those days the president's staff was so small. That, for instance, we all would have lunch at the same time in the same dining room called the White House Mess.
Well, that's something. Mm-hmm. You talk about the fact that when we look at the presidential transitions, that some of them have been fairly rocky, some of them mm-hmm. have not been as rocky. Let's look at the modern transitions here. Which ones could have used quite a bit of change?
Turn it around slightly, because the gold standard, the one that really was quite good, was Ronald Reagan's.
Mm-hmm.
The one that was quite awful was Bill Clinton's.
Mm-hmm.
And they parallel, or they conflict in a strange way. Reagan, of course, had been the governor of California for 8 years, and California really is the only state that has some comparability as a job with being president of the United States. After all, it's our biggest state. It's got the most diverse population, the most diverse industry, the most diverse agriculture. It even had a legislature of the opposition party. So in a strange way, Reagan knew some things going in there. On the other hand, Bill Clinton was the governor of a very, very small state. And what happens, and it happened with Jimmy Carter as well, is, well, they've been very successful as governors, so they think that what they do as governors are going to work as president, because after all, Washington is only Little Rock writ large. And they get here and they find that they almost have to unlearn a lot of the things that they learn and that work for them.
Mm-hmm. You talk about two of them, and I wonder which ones you're referring to were so problematic that two presidents allowed events to go forward, you write, that had lasting adverse international consequences.
Yeah, well, there were some real adverse consequences, of course, because of John F. Kennedy, first with the Bay of Pigs, in which had... he should have known probably not to go forward with it, and didn't. That was a transition experience. And then, of course, had his first summit with the Soviet, and that went so badly that the Soviets got some notions about such things as missiles in Cuba. So I think that was certainly one of them, where the president-elect really needed to be better prepared.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the Soviets reminds me, I think it was Nikita Khrushchev, wasn't it? Write in one part of the book about the various events that you went to and having some fun, but it sounds like the Russians, what year was this, didn't have any fun at one of the events.
That's right. That would have been about 1960. You know, what happened is that I'm never going to write my memoirs. Thank you for saying all the nice things about my career. But in this little book, it gave me an opportunity to sneak in some stories that I could tell about White House events or writing speeches for presidents and that sort of thing. Because as you know, what I did was design this book, just a literary conceit, as a workbook, the same sort of things our kids get in grade school. So if the president-elect would only fill in the worksheets and look up what he has to look up and check things off, he would get successfully, presumably, from his election in November to his inauguration in January. So designed like that, it has these little sidebars, which I have a lot of fun with.
Yeah, they're wonderful. I love this statement, going back to Kennedy for a moment, one of the reasons for the book and for more care with transitions, although Clinton didn't learn from him. If I'm elected, he said to Clark Clifford, I don't want to wake up in the morning of November 9 and I have to ask myself, what in the world do I do now?
Yeah. That was sort of fun to note that, because, of course, the title of my book, What Do We Do Now, is really taken from the Robert Redford movie, the 1972 movie The Candidate. You remember, he's running for senator from California. He's an outside chance, and at the last minute he gets elected, and the last line of the movie is he turns to his campaign manager and says, what do we do now? So that's where I got the title.
Mm-hmm. Is it too early to give a rating to President Barack Obama?
This is a tricky business, very tricky, because right, I would say that going well into January, he had a brilliant transition, faultless transition. And while I'd love to take credit for that, because he does follow many of the prescriptions in my book, I think what happened was that he had turned to design to John Podesta, Bill Clinton's chief of staff, to design the transition. And as I said, I thought Clinton had the worst transition, and Podesta had 16 years to figure out what went wrong. And so he was really designing an un- or a non-Clinton transition. And that was going awfully well. And in fact, they beat all of the deadlines. I have checklists where you're supposed to do certain things by Thanksgiving and certain things by Christmas. And they were just going at it tremendously. And then toward the end, some of the wheels fell off the vehicle, starting with some tax problems Tim Geithner. More importantly, as it turned out, for Tom Daschle, even before that, Bill Richardson dropping out. And you have to ask, you know, what was going on and why. A lot of these things, I think, since I'm not an insider, happened because, in fact, they were working so fast.
Oh.
And it was such an important transition. So much had to be done. So that once they had these problems, starting in the order of Richardson and going through, let's say, to Judd Gregg, they slowed down. They had to do more vetting. They had to call in more people to do the auditing, and that slowed down things even more. The awful part about this, my prejudice let it all hang out, is I was a great enthusiast for Obama and still am. But the bad part about our system is we elect a president for 4 years, and it takes almost 1 year because of the delays in Senate confirmation and so forth for a president to put all of his people in place. Now, I think that's terrible that a fourth of a presidency is being put in place for the only elective official in the executive branch of government. And the problem, of course, now. And they just confirmed a Secretary of Labor yesterday.
Right.
Is that this incredible program that the president told us about and asked for our support yesterday needs implementation, needs the work of all these people in place. And some of the problem right now, we're getting a little off the beaten track, but some of the problem about particularly at the Treasury Department is that these half a dozen people are working night and day, and there isn't even an undersecretary, an assistant secretary, a deputy assistant, all the jobs that are really the hand-in-glove jobs. So they're using consultants, they're using people who are in place as civil servants and so forth, and I would assume that they are exhausted now.
Yeah, I would assume everybody's exhausted when you think of all that's been done in a month period of time.
Yeah,
it is a lot.
Month.
Let's talk about the press secretary for a while, because I think that's important, and you do as well. It's interesting to look at historically at who has been chosen, and you have advice for who to choose. I like Gibbs. I think, at least at this moment, you know, he's personable. He seems incredibly honest. Is his job to defend the president all the time? Is his job to have a little bit of a sense of humor as well? Talk about the good ones, the bad ones.
A sense of humor helps an awful lot. In other words, he's stuck in that room a lot, that briefing room, with 60 or so people who can get a little mean and ornery. and he's not going to be able to answer all their questions. And being able to deflect things with a quick wit and so forth really, really does help. The one who was awfully good at that, I think, was Marlon Fitzwater.
Yes, marvelous.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take phone calls for Stephen. Stephen Hess is our guest. I knew you'd like him. He's the author now of What Do We Do Now? A workbook for the president-elect, which also includes pictures, and we'll go to this in a moment, of whose presidential portrait should be hanging in the Oval Office. And he's a big fan. Well, there are a lot of pictures of one particular president, so we'll talk about that and others. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And Rhonda Fanning is answering phone calls. We can talk about, you know, all kinds of topics, the transitions that you think went well, those that were problematic, what advice Stephen Hess has for cabinet positions as well. All of that's on our table. So phones are open for you. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stephen Hess is our guest. Just a reminder, we're in a pledge drive right now, our winter drive, and we'd love to have you pledge so we can continue these kinds of marvelous discussions with terrific guests. 888-202-2552 is our pledge number. 888-202-2552. WPR.org is where you can go if you'd like to pledge online. Stephen, I love the sidebar of whose picture should hang in the Oval Office? And I can imagine whose you would like there. It's George, right?
Well, you know, it's funny. You know that most presidents are going to hang up some pictures, some portraits of previous presidents. They don't have to, of course. John Kennedy, who was a sailor, actually used maritime scenes that were quite lovely. But when they get right down to it, almost all of them have a George Washington. Mm-hmm. The problem for them, then, is there are lots of George Washingtons to pick from. I mean, they can pick George Washington from the knees up, George Washington just of the head, George Washington in uniform, George Washington out of uniform. So what I do in the book is spread out through the book. I show the portraits that previous presidents have had in the Oval Office, and then in the end, the president-elect, or you, the reader, can pick which one you want. And of course, there's a little description of each artist and each portrait. The other thing that I do, Kathleen, of course, is which desk that the president wants to sit at in the Oval Office. There have been four desks that presidents have used. You don't have to. Again, Lyndon Johnson brought his own. And even these desks have some wonderful histories to them. So again, I show the desks so they can check off which desk they want.
Now, whose picture would you hang? Do you have a favorite?
Well, I had absolutely no doubt that Barack Obama was going to hang Abe Lincoln's picture.
Right.
And I did see a picture of him in the Oval Office a week or so ago. And there I saw Abe Lincoln on the wall, and I saw George Washington on the wall. And I picked the desk that I thought he would pick, which was the one that Kennedy had, the Resolute desk. And I said, there they all are. And then I found out that he hadn't yet redecorated. So these were not his pictures yet. So we'll see what he chooses. But I would be quite sure.
Well, you need to just write him a note saying, I love the office. I love the pictures.
Well, it's such a wonderful, wonderful office.
Yeah, you write about the office, too.
Glorious office. And that's the distinction the president has to make, too. Is he going to work in the office or just use it ceremonially? The president can have another office across the street, as Nixon did, and he can just sneak over there and do all of his work. But I hope that, and I feel confident that this president is going to use this for more than just the ceremonial purpose.
And what's so glorious about it? You write about it in your book.
Oh, well, the shape of it, the ovalness of it, the molding of it, the doors that lead out to the south lawn, the ceiling, the seal of the presidency in the ceiling, and the fireplace, and it's just wonderful, wonderful office. I think it's not huge by any means, it's. You feel that this is where a president should be.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls for you, Stephen Hess. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jim from Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I would like to reference an article on the January 10th Chicago Sun-Times by Joe Connison. It's entitled Frankenbashers, A Bunch of Lying Liars. And it just seems to me that in general, when a Republican is president, the Democrat legislators just roll over, but the Republicans actually actively obstruct. And this is significant in the Franken case because the people of Minnesota still aren't getting any representation. And, of course, Franken not being in cuts Obama's razor-thin working group in the Senate. And it was interesting because the article points out the Minnesota Canvassing Board is impeccably nonpartisan, it's described. And two of the five members were Supreme Court judges appointed by the conservative Republican governor. The third was a nonpartisan elected judge. Fourth was appointed by Jesse Ventura, former independent governor. And only one, the Secretary of State Mark Ritchie, was a Democrat. And at the outset, Coleman's own lawyers accepted the panel's membership, as did everyone else. So the outcome of all of this is, even though this group that is impeccable said that Franken won by 225 votes, of course, the Republicans are still obstructing this in the court and denying the people of the state of Minnesota their representation. And it's just a sad fact that this is another thing that slows down administrative progress.
Stephen.
Well, I don't know what to respond to that. I don't know what's going on in Minnesota. I assume each party has a right to the law, and that eventually there will be a senator, a second senator. I would add something else, and that is if you watched the state of the, it's not a State of the Union, the substitute State of the Union, if you will, last night, and then the opposition response by Bobby Jindal. I should say I didn't think that Bobby Jindal was ready for prime time, but that's not the issue. I think there's a real issue about whether there should be an opposition response to the State of the Union. This is a much more serious public radio sort of comment that I want to make now. In other words, the response to the State of the Union, or the State of the Union, is in the Constitution. It's in Article 2, Section 3. It says he shall from time to time give to the Congress information on the State of the Union, and so forth. There's nothing about a political party or him as an opposition leader. We're not a parliamentary system. Now, what happened is that's the way it was until 1966, when Lyndon Johnson was president and decided that he would move the State of the Union address to prime time. The networks would have to cover it, and that would be a glorious publicity for the president and for his story. Everett McKinley Dirksen, the Republican leader in the Senate, said, "Hey, I'd like to get in on that act," and asked the networks if there could be an opposition reply. The networks at that time, everybody watched those three networks, 95% of Americans, so if they all did the same thing, they weren't losing out anything competitively, and so they said, sure, you know, we're happy to give you some time as well. So suddenly, instead of the president being the president of all the people, which of course he is, he's now put symbolically in the position of being
the
party leader.
Right.
I think this is terrible. I think they should stop this. Now, of course, at the moment, that means the Republicans, but not always. Lots of times it was the Democrats in opposition. So I don't know if any the networks have enough guts to say to the other party, and maybe now they would feel better about it because there were so many cable stations and other types of stations. People aren't fixed to having to watch this, and so they can turn it off. So the loss is not is of a different nature. But anyway, if any of your listeners think that that's a good idea, wouldn't be a bad idea to write the networks or their member of Congress.
All right, Stephen. You may hear from some listeners on whether or not that's a good idea. I wonder how many people just stop listening because it's a long speech that's being given. I don't know how many people watch the opposition party response. Our guest this hour, I could listen to this guy all day. So many stories. What Do We Do Now? A Workbook for the President-Elect. Stephen Hess is our guest and has been advising every transition since he was a young aide, a speechwriter for President Dwight Eisenhower. He's marvelous. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Here to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is our winter pledge drive, and this is the quality of guest you get not just during pledge drives, but all the time. Your contribution really makes these kinds of conversations possible. Easy to make it. Go online, WPR.org, or call 888-202-2552. Mike Crane is in the studio with me, Acting Director and Chief Operating Officer for Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello again, Mike.
It's good to be here, and we're just going to take a few minutes to talk about membership and get back to this great conversation.
Yeah, he's great.
And do want to mention, though, we're working on a $2,500 goal. We still have about $2,100
to go. All right, let's call.
And that's already three new members, which is terrific. Part of the purpose of these pledge drives is to find new members. And we want to tell you, Wisconsin Public Radio is listener-supported, so your pledge, your financial contribution, helps to make this program and the Ideas Network possible. Please contribute now, securely, online at WPR.org, or call us toll-free, 888-202-2552. 2552.
Carol from Madison said she enjoys WPR. It's a very important source of information for her. That's true for me, too. And if it's important information that you can rely on and one of your primary sources, maybe it's the source, maybe you found yourself thinking about something in a new way after you've heard one of our shows, then you should pledge.
Yeah, and it's the beauty of the Ideas Network that you hear multiple points of view. Perhaps you've heard something that's helped to solidify your thoughts on an issue, or maybe you had an aha moment like probably many of us did just the last few minutes.
Exactly.
And you know you value what you hear on the Ideas Network. Please pledge your support right now online at WPR.org or toll free 888-202-2552.
I like that aha moment because those happen all the time, as you know, Mike. And for Stephen Hess to say that he would only say something like this at a serious place, serious conversation, but he's obviously got a great sense of humor, too, to talk about the possibility of eliminating the response to the State of the Union, non-State of the Union speech. That's an interesting idea. You're right. And it will, I know I'll talk about that later today with somebody. Do you think that we should maybe eliminate, why do we need that?
Yeah. I think you could imagine the argument being, well, we need it for X, Y, and Z reasons.
Right.
And one of the things that strikes me about that is that that's the kind of conversation that is, A, inspired by listening to public radio, but also that indicates the thoughtfulness and the willingness to take a real stab at issues that public radio listeners have. And so we invite you to go ahead and make your pledge of support right now. We have that goal of $2,500 and still $2,100 to go. And it will help us to keep on track with the fund drive if we're able to reach that goal this hour. So please get in touch right now. Your pledge helps to pay for the ability of Kathleen and Rhonda and the rest of the crew to work on these great programs. 888-202-2552 is the number for you to call right now. Or please contribute at WPR.org.
Thanks so much, Mike. Stephen Hess is our guest this hour, and his book is What Do We Do Now? A Workbook for the President-Elect. His advice is valuable because he's been advising every transition since he was a speechwriter for Dwight Eisenhower when he was 25 years old. We're taking phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. Rich from Rhinelander is next. Hello, Rich.
Hi. First, I want to say everybody should call up and pledge.
Right. Thanks, Rich.
But,
you're right.
But I watched both speeches last night, the president's and then Governor Jindal's. And I watched them on Wisconsin Public Television, so I caught David Brooks and Mark Shields' commentary. What happened this morning was watching television news, and not Wisconsin Public Television. I watch like CBS and NBC and ABC. There were a couple hosts and guests who were just lauding Bobby Jindal's remarks as though he presented this brilliant response to the big government tax and spend people. And a family member asked me, well, where is that coming from? Because he really did seem, as I think David Brooks said, not quite ready for prime time Jindal last night. And my response was what I once asked Bob McChesney about. I said, these people are all at six figures or better, and by that I mean the major news media people are earning quite a bit of money compared to the rest of us. And I'm wondering if Mr. Hess, if he's still available, could comment on that. I'm actually accusing them of sort of a class bias in terms of saying we may get hit fairly hard here because many of us, or hit at least tax-wise, many of us easily earn over $250,000 a year, and sometimes per person in their household. That I'm sorry to go on so long, but you get the point.
I got the point, and it's a good point, Stephen.
Well, I couldn't comment on things I didn't hear, so I don't know who Rich was talking about. If he had been listening on National Public Radio, he would have heard E.J. Dionne, who was, I'm looking across at his desk right now here at Brookings, and would have had a different point of view. I don't know how much EJ makes, but I do know that he's a progressive and a great enthusiast for the president, at least judging from his column this mm-hmm. morning in the Washington Post. I think that in some ways that is an odd comment that Rich made, assuming he's talking about the journalists as opposed to all of these whatever they are. Commentators, they call themselves, who line up and are expected to have a point of view. If you were watching any of the cable stations, for example, you would see people who are there not as journalists, but because they were campaign consultants and,
sure.
and otherwise. I don't really think that that's the issue with the journalists. They, at least the ones that I know. So I wouldn't do much casting aspersions, or as my kids say, casting asparagus.
Thanks, Rich, so much for your call. Always welcome. Let's go next to Paul from Milwaukee. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good, good. Regarding the art that would be hung up in the Oval Office, I think it shouldn't be any president. I think it should be WPA art, because it would reflect the condition of the mm-hmm. situation today, and also to remind us that even in the most dire times, there is art that can uplift you.
Mm.
That's a great mm-hmm. a great thought, by the way. A great thought. To anybody who knows the WPA art, some of the great artists that were involved in it. Let me just tell you a little thing that I did. One of the great perks of being an aide to the president is you can call up the National Gallery and say, could I borrow some art to hang on my wall? Now, I was in 1969. I was the deputy assistant president for urban affairs. Cities were my problem. Basically, I was the chief of staff for Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and I called up and I said, "I want some great black artists," and I had the most marvelous mm-hmm. collection. Jacob Lawrence and others on my wall, and I wrote each one a letter if they were alive, saying that they now hung in the White House. There's nothing more I could do for them. I didn't pay for the art, but I did want them to know that I loved it and that it was in that it was now hanging in the White House. I had an absolutely marvelous. A piece in very bright colors by an artist I love named Elma Thomas, and I would love to have been able to afford one of her works, but it cheered me up a great deal every morning as I went in. So I think that's a nifty idea, very worth passing on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Thanks so much for your call. We go next to Dave from Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to get you guests' thoughts on how the Republican Party is trying to deal with being the opposition of a black president. Now, they've got Michael Steele heading the RNC, and now Bobby Jindal coming out with responses, and he is the new, what they call the up-and-coming new star. And, you know, for a party that is probably 99.7% white, to use these guys to display these guys literally to try to fool the country that we are a diverse party. We too have people that are not white with us, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, on absolutely how ridiculous it looks and how just blatantly transparent it is.
Okay, Stephen.
Well, I guess I'm set back by all of this, including the partisan tone of all these questions, particularly about the Republican Party. The Republican Party is in opposition, of course. It disagrees strongly with the president, which was pretty clear on the stimulus bill. And I think it's perfectly fair, as the president at least feels, that you can have perfectly honest disagreements. In other words, I'm sad because I was what was then known as a moderate Republican. I was once the assistant to Senator Thomas Kuchel of California, who was the minority whip, the Republican whip in the Senate when I was there. And we as moderates controlled, I say, about a third of the party. So we had a true voice in it. Now, obviously, from what happened with the stimulus bill, that number is down to three. Two senators from Maine and Arlen Specter. So nobody is being fooled about where the Republican Party is coming from, and they disagree. If they all agreed, then we would have one party too many. So that's about where it is. Who they want to choose to give their message. Last night, he was a sitting governor, interesting man. They chose of the array of candidates that they had running for Republican national chairman. I think they actually chose the best of the lot. So I don't really have to attack the color of the people that they're chosen any more than I'd want the color of the president being attacked.
Thanks, Steve, very much for the call. I think this word should be resurrected. You write in the book about the only piece of memorabilia you keep in your office, and tell the story behind the word. It's a good one. Gloomdoggle.
Gloomdoggle.
Okay.
Yeah. This goes back to when I was a speechwriter for President Eisenhower, and it was the 1958 campaign, which was a devil of a recession at that time, and the Republicans were going to lose a lot of seats in Congress, and I was busy writing the president's speeches for the campaign, and I was told to call the Democratic Party the party of gloom and doom. And by the very last speech he was to give, which was the Friday before the election, from Baltimore, from a big armory there, I was so sick of gloom and doom that I decided to invent the word that the Democrats were gloomdogglers. That was the old Depression word, boondoggler, meaning make work. Well, if you can make work, you can make gloom. And so I put that in the speech. Our speeches were vetted by a sort of a murder board of lawyers. We could never have had the situation that George W. Bush had on his words about nuclear, was it white, yellow cake? Right. And it was very tough to get through these lawyers who wanted to explain every word that you put in there. And finally, just as my word was to get knocked down from out of the speech, Malcolm Moose's, my boss's wife, happened to pop into the office, and she was very excited about the word. It's sort of as a gesture to her, they left the word in. And Eisenhower loved the word. When I could get past all of these people who were busy with their red pencils and could get it into Eisenhower, who had been a speechwriter himself for Douglas MacArthur, actually, he would like these little flourishes. They didn't happen very often. So we went over to Baltimore that night to hear the president give the speech with my word, gloomdoggler. And as we walked out of the armory, there was the bulldog edition of the Baltimore Sun, broadsheet, eight columns across. And it said, I'm looking at it right now, because as I say, it's the only thing framed in my office, Ike calls Democrats gloomdogglers. and so it's framed it up on my wall. And I thought I had really invented a word forever and ever. It lasted about 24, 48 hours, and never seen again.
It's about to be resurrected. Okay. Stephen, I think you're wonderful. I'd like to see a whole lot more of you. We're talking about commentators. You ought to have your own show. You've got this breadth of experience and marvelous way of speaking.
Well, you're listening
you're
to
really
the wrong
good.
One. Actually, I'm the John Madden of Irish TV.
Ah.
Whenever there's a presidential event and they send over their
really?
Anchor, Yeah, I sit next to the anchor, as I did for the inauguration.
No.
I did for the parade, and I sit and do the color on that way. So,
Stephen.
I may not be big in Milwaukee, but boy, in Dublin, I'm pretty well known.
Wow, there's nothing better than being known in Dublin. That's a great spot. See, we could probably find you. I didn't know you did that. We'll have to find you on the internet somehow. You're marvelous. Thank you. Please join us again. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Hess, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stephen Hess, our guest this hour. Isn't he just marvelous? And I heard him on the radio, actually. I thought, oh, we have to get him. He is so good. The book, What Do We Do Now? A Workbook for the President-Elect. And we have guests like this all the time. It's really something. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We're asking for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio right now because you make these kinds of programs possible. Go online, please, WPR.org, or call 888-202-2552. Mike Crane is joining me now. He's the Acting Director and Chief Operating Officer for Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, Mike. Wasn't he marvelous? I just really like this guy.
Just really dynamic.
Yeah.
And found out new things. I had no idea Eisenhower was a speechwriter.
No, I didn't know that either.
A lot of aha moments, as we said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And we invite you to call right now with your pledge of support or go online and do it that way. Maybe you don't want the boss to know that you're making a contribution right now. And we've got $1,700 to go to reach our goal of $2,500. So we invite you to get in touch right now. Wisconsin Public Radio is listener-supported. Fully a third of our budget comes from people like you. So your pledge helps to make this program possible. And you can make your contribution at WPR.org, where we have a secure web server, or give us a call, 888-202-2552.
And your contribution really is so important to us. I mean, we bring you people like Stephen Hess. Stephen was, I think, he's wonderful. We'll have him on again. He's got a great sense of humor. He has this incredible history working with both Republican presidents and Democratic presidents. Plus, he does the color commentary on politics for Irish television. I didn't even know that. What more can you ask for in a guest, I ask you? So please, you have access to guests like this, great information, and information you will not hear anywhere else. Please call. We want to make the goal this hour. And you can help us do that by calling, and I know you will, 888-202-2552 or pledge online, WPR.org.
Well, what does making a pledge mean? Well, of course, we pledge and you pledge. So we pledge to bring you great programming every day. And we ask you to pledge to support it with a financial contribution in any amount. And we mean that.
Mm-hmm.
If $5 is what you can pledge right now, that would be terrific because we want you to be part of the family. If $500 is what you could do because that fits your means, if $5,000 is what your means can do, every dollar makes a difference. So please get in touch at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 right now to make your contribution.
And we want to let you know that we give money for things that are important to us, for mortgage or rent. It's important. Food is important. Dinner out with friends, a vacation with our family. They're important as well. And they add to the quality of our lives and build our relationships. We're keeping voices alive here on the radio as well. There aren't very many places you can go and hear an interview like that and have us noticed because I knew that you would like this guy and that he had a lot to say and over half a century of working with various presidents, he's worthwhile. We got to keep these voices alive. If you want to pledge and keep these kinds of voices alive, now is the time to do just that.
You know, because WPR is important to you, we ask you to please invest in it. Support the programs that you enjoy and rely upon each day. Just go online at WPR.org or call toll-free 888-202-2552.
And did we mention that bag? You can carry so many things if you go to the grocery store. If you pledge $35, isn't that right, Mike? $35.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
You'll get a green bag, and that's our special thank you to you this particular hour. So when you go shopping for books or groceries or whatever, we would be happy to send this to you. Every dollar, as Mike said, makes a difference. Every gift matters. $60 here, $120 there. An occasional $1,000 contribution or two, which would be terrific. Please make your contribution. Individual donations from thousands of listeners, just like you, make up the largest share of our budget.
We're counting on you. So help us to reach this goal. We're working on a goal of $2,500, and we know there's someone on the line right now that's working on it, but there's still a lot more to raise, about $1,700 to raise.
Right.
So please get in touch. It's at WPR.org, or you can call us toll-free, and it's an 888 number, 888-202-2552.
This goal of 2,500 is important. It keeps us staying on track for this membership drive and this budget cycle. And it's important to us because of the quality of this particular guest as well. We'd like to have him back sometime, and I'd like to know that you appreciated him. I think he's, you know, terrific. Help us reach the goal right now with your pledge of support. We have $1,765 to go. We ought to be able to do it, Mike, if we get calls at 888-202-2552 or go online at WPR.org.
Well, you mentioned the bag. I wanted to mention a little bit more about it.
Okay.
Of course, we use a ton of plastic bags in this country. We looked it up. If we tied our annual usage of plastic bags together in a chain, it would go around the earth 760 times.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we have a solution to part of that, which is the WPR-labeled reusable shopping bag. And it's just an incentive to try to help you make that first pledge, perhaps, at $35 at WPR.org. And we'll ask you to do that online to get that because, by the way, going online is the least expensive way for WPR to raise the money. And then we'll be happy to send you the lightweight reusable bag. I know I've got one that I carry in my backpack so that if I need to pick up a couple of groceries on the way home, I can put it in there. Really a nice way to do that. And that's with a pledge of $35. Call 888-202-2552 or go online to WPR.org.
And here again is the website, WPR.org, with your pledge of $35. Select the WPR reusable bag from the list of thank yous and help the planet. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help the planet and to help Wisconsin Public Radio with your pledge at WPR.org. We really would like to reach our goal this hour because of the nature of the guest and the conversations, political conversations we've had for years. Thanks, Mike, very much. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and for on-air production as well. And thanks for all of your pledges, everybody. Just keep them rolling in. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.